Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from Next Gen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the programme Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Every Saturday afternoon between 2:30 and 4, this is the place where you can hear Christians and non-Christians discussing, debating, having a good old discussion on whether God exists, whether the Bible is reliable, and all kinds of other things as well. Philosophy, history, ethics, all sorts. And I'd like to introduce both my guests on the programme in just a moment's time. But if you want these kinds of debates in your ear, in your iPod, to listen to at any time of the week, then why not go along to the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can download the podcast there. You can find links to other features and resources too. That's the website of Unbelievable, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I've been teasing you for a while now, if you're a regular listener, that we are going to be releasing the videos from Unbelievable, the conference 2013 soon. They're still in production. We've got a busy video team here and they're cracking on with them as time allows. And as soon as they're available, I will be letting you know. So stay tuned for more on that. That's the videos from Unbelievable, the conference 2013. They'll be out in the course of the summer. We've got a lot of your feedback as well, of course, to recent programs. Apologies if you were trying to get in touch, though, this week via the Unbelievable email address. We had a switchover of servers, which meant that you may have, if you emailed in the last week, got a bounce back from my email. It's sorted now, so do feel free to send your responses into today's programme to the usual email address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And we'll see what you've been saying about recent programmes a little later on in the show. Right now, let me introduce today's protagonists and the subject.
You're unbelievable.
We're talking today about the probability of the resurrection of Christ. Well, Callum Miller is a young Christian apologist and Oxford Medical graduate. He's also studying philosophy under Richard Swinburne. He blogs at dovetheology.com and is one of the founders of the Apologetics UK Facebook group and website. Well, he's going to be in discussion today on this subject of the resurrection of Christ with another bright young thing, this time from across the pond. Chris Halquist is a young atheist blogger. He's a trenchant critic, though, of apologetics, especially some of the best-known names like William Lane Craig. He blogs at The Uncredible Hulk. A very warm welcome to both of you, gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today.
And thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Nice to talk to you, Chris.
Chris, great to have you on the programme. First of all, I love the name, The Uncredible Hulk.
Thanks.
You've kind of been carving out a name for yourself as a blogger, an atheist blogger in particular, especially interacting with issues around Christian apologetics. But take us back to where this all began. What kind of sparked this interest?
In terms of my interest in Christian apologetics, I grew up in what is, at least by standards in the United States, in a fairly liberal Christian church, and took it fairly seriously in my early teens. Though when I was 16, I realized that I really couldn't believe this stuff. And then, I was always a big reader and picking up books, came across, Christian apologetics, starting with, Lee Strobel. At first, some of their arguments look superficially convincing. But then, when I started doing things like, checking their sources, picking up the authors they were citing as, supposedly supporting their claims, in some cases I was, just shocked by how inaccurate many of their claims were. You know, I started a blog for myself when I was 18 on blogspot.com, which everyone was using back then. No one's using anymore. And I've moved through a few blogging networks. Like I said, I had my own WordPress blog for a while. Then I was on Freethought blogs. And I'm no longer on Freethought blogs. I'm on Pathios. And you can find me there at pathios.com/blogs/Hulk, which is H-A as in Apple, L-L-Q.
That's how you got to where you are. But was it kind of seeing bad apologetics that made you kind of this your area of critiquing apologetics? I mean, what particularly kind of makes you want to get up in the morning and write a blog about Christian apologetics or against Christian apologetics?
Well, a lot of days I don't. At this point in my life, I've written so much about it, I'm sometimes not sure what I have left to say. But at the same time, you know, I feel like over, you know, since I've been spending so much time on it, I know a lot about it, and I have knowledge that I can, you know, share with other people, and I can, you know, save people who are just starting into these things some trouble and warn them about, you know, sources that may be misleading, and help them figure that out without, you know, actually having to take the trip to the university library to, you know, check all the sources and do all the fact checking all over again.
Are there any apologetic arguments that you do rate, or do you really think that none of them hold water as far as you're concerned?
I think none of them hold water as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, maybe on the defensive side, you know, I mean, not every atheist argument is good, and there are some atheist arguments where, you know, there's a good apologetic response. But, you know, the positive arguments for things like the existence of God and the resurrection of Jesus, I don't think any of them are terribly good.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you, Chris, obviously, as we start to get into this discussion on the probability of the resurrection of Christ, something we've never really done from this angle. We've certainly talked about arguments for the resurrection on this radio show before with a number of people, Bart Ehrman, Mike Lacona, Gary Habermas, and others well known for writing and speaking in this area. But this is a sort of an interesting side aspect, and I'm very pleased to welcome into the studio again Callum Miller, who, as I mentioned, is a young Christian apologist based out in Oxford, studying philosophy, though, sort of as a side area of interest under a well-known Christian philosopher, Richard Swinburne. So welcome back to the studio, Callum.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back. You were last with us, I think, talking about whether atheism is just a sort of lack of belief in God and that sort of thing with a couple of other unbelievable listeners back at the beginning of the year. But what, in the same way that I asked Chris, what has sparked your interest in defending the faith, doing Christian apologetics?
So I've always been quite inquisitive and wanting to kind of really have good reasons for the views I hold. And I've always been quite argumentative and stubborn, quite antagonistic, and sometimes contrarian. So a lot of it is just kind of getting to debate views I had or whatever views I had at a particular time since I was back in high school. But kind of as I got older, I started reading material to do with this, to do with the resurrection, and I found it quite convincing, and I thought the evidence actually was in favour of the resurrection and in favour of these things.
Apologetics has been, in that sense, quite important for you in firing your faith and indeed supporting your faith,
yeah.
Because you wouldn't always describe yourself as having been a Christian.
No, so I didn't believe, for example, that Jesus was God until just a couple of years ago. So that was just before I started university. And so kind of reading the evidence to do with that really was quite influential in that change and me coming to believe things to do with Christianity. And so I wouldn't be able to be a Christian unless I genuinely believed it to be true. And I can only believe something to be true if I have what seems to me sufficient evidence. So yeah, it has been really important to me personally.
And you're one of a few folk who have founded a new sort of community for people interested in apologetics in the UK. Apologetics UK, they've got a Facebook group that people can apply to join and so on. There's also the website, apologeticsuk.blogspot.co.uk. And you've got your own blog as well, dovetheology.com. Now, what interests me, though, Callum, is that you sometimes ruffle feathers within the apologetics community, because you're obviously someone who thinks very precisely and clearly through arguments, because you, for instance, have critiqued William Lane Craig's Kalam cosmological argument, which many apologists, you know, would see as sort of a key sort of modern apologetic argument for the existence of God, but one that, having looked into, you're not so sure apologists should be so reliant upon.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm always happy just to go where my reason, where the evidence takes me. And so some arguments for Christianity, even ones that are very popular, I just don't think are very good. So I actually did a very informal poll of Christian apologists' view of the Kalam argument, and it seems that like over 90% of them really love it. So I was quite, again, being quite contrarian with that. But yeah, I posted this article just because there are a lot of problems, I think, with the Kalam argument. And I just wanted to air them. People always ask me what my issues with it were, and so I thought I might as well just post this. I haven't had any responses yet from William Lane Craig, but he might get around to it eventually. We'll see.
It's interesting because obviously I'm sure what you've written with your problems are things that Chris would fully endorse from his perspective, but obviously we're not here to talk about the Kalam cosmological argument today, but rather an argument which you do find has credibility and value in Christian apologetics, which is this issue of the resurrection of Christ. Now, I've never done a show, and for me this is somewhat new myself, and so please treat me as a newcomer on this, and I'm sure that will help many people listening who perhaps are not familiar with this area. But it's all to do with the probability of the resurrection of Christ. Now, this is something that Richard Swinburne, who, as I mentioned, you've been studying under, has written about himself. Just give us a little taster of what's at the core of this argument to do with the resurrection.
So the idea with probability as a whole is that our beliefs generally come in degrees. We're certain about some things, not so certain about other things. We think other things are probably not true. Some things are certainly not true. And so we have varying kind of levels and degrees of confidence in all the beliefs we have. And so probability theory is really just a way to describe how confident we should be in various beliefs. And so it gives us rules for kind of saying when we should be really confident of something, rules for saying when we should be kind of more unsure, and so on. And actually, there are quite a few what are called theorems which follow from probability theory, which tell us quite a bit about how we can analyze evidence and come to probabilities of things. So the idea is that what we really want in the end is to come up with the probability of the resurrection given all the evidence we have. And there are various factors that come into that. So there's what's called the confirmation of the resurrection, the explanatory power. And this is basically the idea that there is a lot of evidence which, if the resurrection happened, would be expected. But if the resurrection didn't happen, it would be very improbable. And if this is true, if there really is this kind of evidence, then it follows from probability theory that our confidence in the resurrection should be greatly increased by this evidence. Now, that doesn't mean that just because there's any kind of evidence, we should necessarily think the resurrection happened, because it might be that there is a little bit of evidence of the resurrection, but that the resurrection is still really improbable, even considering the evidence. So you also have to take into account what's called the prior probability of the resurrection. And the idea here is that more kind of extraordinary or extreme events will be more improbable to begin with, and so they'll need more evidence to confirm them. And so a lot of the debate about the resurrection comes down to the prior probability and whether we think it's actually really improbable and no possible evidence could ever make us convinced of it.
Yeah, so this is the distinction. There's both the data that we have, and the theory, the best explanation of that data being the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. But there's also this prior probability, which impacts on whether that explanation is in itself probable, as a whether it gets off the ground to begin with, in some sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so So a lot of the debate about the resurrection focuses solely on the evidence, and it says, actually, the resurrection has loads of explanatory power because we wouldn't really expect an empty tomb and appearances of Jesus if the resurrection didn't happen, but we would if the resurrection did happen. So the resurrection is the best explanation. But actually, that doesn't really take into account all the factors, because the resurrection might in itself be a really terrible, complex, improbable hypothesis. And so... So yeah, one of the things Richard Swinburne does that most other people don't do is he gives a really kind of extended account of how we can come up with some kind of prior probability for the resurrection.
Well, we'll get into all this, and obviously Chris is going to be taking issue with this. Chris himself has written at some length on the resurrection, and so we'll come straight back to Chris in a moment's time. But that's an outline of what we're doing. Now, this is a somewhat technical debate, technical discussion today, And I am very much the learner here, and so we're applying the KISS principle, which is keep it simple, stupid, both for myself and for many people listening who perhaps this is new to probability theory and so on, isn't something they've perhaps looked into. So that's what we're aiming to do on the program today, keep it as accessible as possible with two people who really know what they're talking about. My guests today are Callum Miller and Chris Hallquist, and we're going to be talking, as I've mentioned, about the probability of the resurrection of Christ. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the weekly radio show that brings Christians and non-Christians together to discuss these kinds of issues. Don't forget, we're on Twitter if you want to get in touch that way. At UnbelievableJB is my handle. You can also find us on Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to like the Unbelievable Facebook page. Don't forget, you can get in touch by email. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, Chris, we heard Callum's brief sort of pricey introduction to probability theory. You've obviously done debates, written on the issue of whether the resurrection of Jesus is a good explanation for the facts, the data surrounding that. Callum's briefly mentioned some of those things, the historical accounts of the empty tomb, people claiming to have been witnesses to a resurrected Jesus, and there are other data that you could also bring to bear as well. What for you are the fundamental issues that for you have never made the resurrection seem like a good explanation of those kinds of data?
Well, there are a few issues here. I think that it matters enormously what you make of modern miracle accounts. Like, you know, you have people like Pat Robertson even today claiming that, you know, resurrections are happening in Africa, and the reason they don't happen in you know, countries like the UK and the US is because we don't have enough faith. But, you know, in places where they have enough faith, people are rising from the dead today. And, you know, if you accept that, there's a whole conversation to be had about, you know, why you should be skeptical of that. Though I get the impression that that's probably not Callum's view, that Callum would probably be almost as skeptical as I am of those types of claims. And then the question becomes, if you reject those types of claims, what makes the resurrection any different? What is any better about the evidence for the resurrection? Or I don't know, don't know a great deal about the alleged evidence for that, you know, Pat Robertson would cite for miracles in Africa, but perhaps a better example would be, you know, Mormonism and the things that supposedly happened when Mormonism was founded. Why should we believe if some Christians will say that, well, you know, maybe the miracles of other religions are the work of demons, but if you don't say that, if you think that there was no supernatural events involved in, say, the founding of Mormonism, then the big question is, how do you justify, you know, accepting the miracle claims involving Jesus while rejecting, you know, say, the claims of Mormonism, for example?
Mm. Well, this is the question, I suppose. So, Callum, just be interested for you to chip in on that then. What for you makes the resurrection stand out in its evidentiary claims against a Mormon's claims about their particular religious views?
Yeah, well, I think this is partly difficult because Mormonism seems to be such kind of an American religion, I don't really know too much about it. I've never met a Mormon in my life, so I never really felt the need to investigate it too much. What my American friends tell me, again, this is just, I'll admit I don't know much about it. I have American friends who I trust very much, who are very well educated in epistemology and very well educated in Mormonism and those kind of claims. For them, they just seem to think that Mormonism is more probably just deceitful or misled or something like that. I can't speak too much about that because I don't know much about it. But I can obviously say a little bit more about the resurrection and what makes that stand out for me. And as I kind of mentioned at the start, there are various factors that make me think it's probable and make me think it's convincing. Obviously, one of those is the data we have, the evidence we have, like the empty tomb, the appearances to Jesus' disciples, which no doubt would have been discussed on this show 1,000 times. But I just think that the naturalistic accounts, the non-resurrection explanations of those data, just are often themselves very improbable or contrived, and they just don't, they struggle to explain the data, whereas the resurrection makes the data expected. And so I think there's quite a lot of good confirmation of the resurrection by the evidence.
I mean, Chris, you've been a trenchant critic of people like William Lane Craig, as I've mentioned. Now he almost always in his debates uses the resurrection of Christ in among his arguments for the existence of God. Very often citing those same data that Callum just mentioned, that a broad swathe of biblical historians, even if they don't believe in the resurrection per se, do agree on certain minimal facts about the resurrection, that the empty tomb appearances, and there are other things you can throw in as well. And his contention is that the best explanation of those facts is a resurrection rather than a naturalistic hypothesis, whether it be a swoon theory or some contrived sort of moving of the body here and there and whatever. Now, firstly, I suppose I'd like to know, do you think that this data is as good as Christian apologists sometimes claim? And secondly, why, even if it were, you still don't think a divine explanation is warranted?
Yeah, well, frankly, you know, these claims like the empty tomb and the supposed appearances, I think it's, you know, frankly absurd to call them evidence, or, you know, these are claims that you need evidence for. And even if, you know, if you're trying to actually do your probability calculations correctly, you know, even if you think you've got fairly good evidence for, say, the empty tomb, that doesn't mean you're allowed to, you know, set your probabilities equal to one and, you know, ignore the possibility you've made a mistake in thinking you've got good evidence for the empty tomb. And similarly, I think it's, you know, absurd to call them facts. These are, you know, claims that the evidence is pretty thin for. There are lots of, you know, New Testament scholars who think that the story of Jesus' empty tomb is just a myth. And there is more consensus that, you know, some of Jesus' early followers probably really did think they'd seen, you know, Jesus alive after his death, though personally there, I think, you know, even more skeptical scholars like John Dominic Crossan and Gerd Ludemann haven't, you know, paid enough attention to the possibility that, you know, people like the Apostle Paul were simply lying. Whether you think that's the most likely explanation, and I tend to, you know, lean towards thinking Paul was sincere, but whether or not that's the most likely explanation, you know, whether or not it's very likely that they were lying, you know, to call it a fact or a data point that needs to be explained, to call their, you know, alleged sincerity a fact is really stretching things. You know, so the only data we really have to explain is the Bible. You know, there's very few references in the first century AD. There's like one non-Christian reference to the life of Jesus in a book that, you know, we're pretty sure early Christians tampered with. That would be the works of Josephus. You know, so really the data to explain is the Bible.
Okay. Let's bring in Callum at this point. Callum, what's... I mean, we're going to focus not just on data, but on this probability issue. But what kind of figures have you seen in terms of the sort of probabilities that people put on these various historical aspects of the tradition surrounding the resurrection?
So I actually agree with Chris that that we need to use the most certain data we have. So he's right in saying when we're coming up with our probability calculations, the evidence we really have is, of course, the reports of empty tombs and the reports of appearances and so on. So I agree with that. And I actually don't think it would be too controversial to say that there's at least some confirmation of the resurrection, even if just a tiny bit. This is because, for example, if the resurrection happened, we would expect there to be a report of the empty tomb with kind of near certainty. It's almost certain that if a resurrection happened, someone would report that there was an empty tomb or that Jesus appeared to people. Whereas if the resurrection didn't happen, obviously there's debate about how improbable these things, these reports would be. Mm. But we can at least say, I think, that the reports would be slightly less
probable. And would other data, for instance, something that's brought up very often in this context is the unlikeliness of this theology kind of a resurrection before the end of time in Jewish sort of theology being invented, as it were. That would have been a very strange view for to be imported as a sort of fabrication. And so that's seen in some ways by the criterion of embarrassment as, well, you'd only say that if it had actually happened, as it were. Is that another example of this sort of probability of these things as far as the explanation is concerned?
Yeah, so things that would be good evidence are things that, for the resurrection, will be things that would be probable given the resurrection, but really, really, really improbable if the resurrection didn't happen. Whereas kind of only moderate, mild evidence will be things that might still work, like might well still happen even if the resurrection didn't happen.
Okay.
Obviously, if you have really improbable things like the making up of a resurrection, given the context of Jewish theology, obviously that will provide at least some evidence for the resurrection happening. Obviously there's debate about how improbable these things are otherwise, but I agree with Chris that you need to use the most certain data, but I disagree with him on how strongly that data supports the resurrection, I think.
We're going to come back to this, and I'm going to ask you about your tutor, Richard Swinburne, and the probability that he's come up with for the resurrection as well, and be interested to hear Chris's response to that in a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable. Believe it or not, we're already through the first half of the program, and we've hardly gone into the issue. But we're talking about the probability of the resurrection of Christ, and we'll be continuing to talk about this with Callum Miller, a young Christian apologist from Oxford, and Chris Halquist, who's a young atheist blogger in the States. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. Don't forget we're online as well. You can download many, many past programmes at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And today we're talking about really the core doctrine of Christianity, one of them at least, the resurrection of Christ. We've often done programmes looking at arguments for and against the resurrection of Christ. Today, a slightly different angle. We're talking about the probability theory behind the resurrection of Christ. And joining me in the studio is Callum Miller, a young Christian apologist, who is currently studying some philosophy under Richard Swinburne, who's developed probably some of the most interesting work in the area of probability, evidence and the resurrection. Chris Halquist is our young atheist protagonist, also speaking from his experience against the resurrection of Christ. We were just saying in that last section, Callum, just talking about the bits of evidence which, if the resurrection had happened, makes them, it's very probable that these events would occur given a resurrection, very improbable that we would have these things if a resurrection didn't occur. Now, I've heard it said that Richard Swinburne puts a 0.97 probability that the resurrection really happened. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that actually mean? Is he saying that the resurrection is 97% certain that it did happen, given the data? Can you just kind of give us an idea of what he actually means with this?
Yeah. So one of the first things I think to clarify is that he says these are kind of artificially precise values. He doesn't actually think the resurrection has like an exactly 0.97 probability of having happened. So he admits that they're kind of rough ballpark figures. And what he actually does in his book is he comes up with these rough figures and he says, these are values, I think, which are generous to the atheist case. I think an atheist would be perfectly reasonable to accept this. And I actually think the case is stronger for the resurrection myself. But I think...
So in fact, he would go personally beyond 97% in that sense.
Yeah. And so he basically says to make the resurrection less than 0.5 to give the resurrection less than a 0.5 chance of having happened, you need to really change the values I've given for various probabilities. You need to basically think that I've completely messed up the entire thing to make it that
so
much
for,
lower.
For instance, if the resurrection came out on this probability theory as 0.5, would that mean essentially that it's about half as likely it didn't happen as it did happen? Is that sort of the way it works in the probability?
So yeah, if it was 0.5, you should be basically completely agnostic. You should think it's as probable that it did happen as that it didn't happen.
I see. Okay. I mean, this all is popping up questions in my mind about, well, is this the way Christians ever think about what they believe in terms of pure probabilities and so on? We can come to that later on. But Chris, be interested in your general comments on this way of approaching the evidence with these probabilities. You've already voiced concerns that it seems bizarre to you to start labeling certain facts or data with precise probabilities.
Yeah, so I don't know if we've mentioned the name of the key probability theory theorem, but the key probability theory theorem here is Bayes' theorem, and it's a perfectly good theorem as, you know, for calculating probabilities, as long as you actually can, you know, assign the right numbers to plug into the equation, which I think sometimes is, you know, not necessarily practical and not the best way to approach these things, because, you know, thinking about quite what numbers to plug into these equations can be difficult to do. But, you know, if you want to phrase the argument this way and you're careful about how you go about assigning probabilities, I don't think it's necessarily a bad way to frame things, or, you know, will necessarily screw everything up, you know, totally.
I mean, Callum said there that he, as far as he understands it, coming up with this 0.97 probability, in fact, Swinburne has been quite generous to the atheist and sort of said you there's only a fairly minimal amount you need to accept in terms of the historical data to come up with this as a probability. Now, do you just think that he's somehow put the figures completely wrong on this, whatever they were?
Yeah. You know, it's been a while since I've read Swinburne's book all the way through, but it seems to me that one of the, you know, key mistakes he makes is, you know, he spends much of the book, you know, essentially trying to make an a priori case for Christian theology to, you know, sort of up the probability of, you know, the resurrection, because, oh, here's, you know, okay, we've made our case for sort of Christian theology in the abstract without, you know, directly referring to Jesus. And then, you know, lo and behold, we've got this religion or this religious figure who matches, you know, what we allegedly sort of did a priori from the armchair. You know, the problem is that and that's, you know, in terms of probability theory, it's what gives Swinburne a reasonably high prior probability for the resurrection, and that's how he defends that, you know, assigning a reasonably high prior probability to the resurrection. You know, but I look at that and, you know, just think that, you know, this is going to be totally unconvincing to anyone who, you know, is not already a Christian. Not only it's going to be totally unconvincing to atheists, it's going to be, you know, totally unconvincing to Muslims who have, you know, theological objections to the idea of, you know, God becoming incarnate. It's going to be, you know, not at all convincing to, you know, Jews who are familiar with, you know, the standard Jewish responses to Christian apologetics involving messianic prophecy and so on, you know, it seems that, you know, basically the prior probability argument and his handling of, you know, the posterior probabilities and the evidence isn't great either. But the biggest mistake is that, you know, he's giving these arguments for his prior probability number that are only going to convince people who are already Christians.
Okay. Let's talk about prior probability, because this is slightly distinguished from what Chris has just called posterior probability. Mm-hmm. Now, before we get too bogged down in these terms, what is Swinburne talking about when he talks about a prior probability of the resurrection, Callum?
So there are these technical terms in what's called Bayesianism, which Chris referred to, which is basically the prior and posterior probabilities. And the idea here is that the prior probability is the probability of something before you look at the evidence for it.
Mm.
And then when you have the evidence that comes in, you update your probability using Bayes' theorem.
So it's kind of you take these two probabilities and combine them, essentially, to give you your overall probability.
To give you your posterior probability.
Okay.
And so the way the resurrection argument, for example, would work is that they'd say, actually, the prior probability is low, but it's not kind of insuperably low. Kind of the resurrection might have happened, but it's probably it's quite improbable. But given the evidence we have, once we use the evidence to update that probability, the posterior probability of the resurrection is actually very probable, very high indeed. And so a lot of the debate, as Chris rightly notes, focuses on the prior probabilities, and that's it should do. I think that's a really important
And the
area.
Prior probability, one of the key ones, obviously, is whether God exists to start with. That is pretty important, because if it's likely that God exists, then you open up the possibility of miracles to start with.
Yeah. And so, again, Swinburne does a lot more than most people do, and he actually takes in a lot more of the relevant factors than other people do. So some people will say that it's irrelevant what evidence you have from natural theology, and it's irrelevant, all these other things are irrelevant. What you should just focus on is the reports of the empty tomb and so on. But actually, it turns out when you try to come up with a prior probability of the resurrection, factors like the evidence of natural theology become
And by
really
natural
important.
Theology, you're talking about evidences for the existence of God from nature, from cosmology, yeah, fine-tuning, other philosophical arguments and so on.
Yeah.
So he kind of assigns a value to all these arguments for the existence of God, which raises overall the probability that Jesus was therefore raised from the dead.
Yeah,
is what we're looking at. Now, the problem Chris is outlining here is, well, I just don't agree with him on how good these arguments are. Chris isn't convinced at all by these arguments. So how does, is it just a sort of Swinburne's own sort of Christian bias, which is plugging these sort of values onto these arguments for the existence of God, which then obviously in turn raise the probability of the resurrection? I guess that's the question for you, Callum. Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, so I mean, Swinburne has been criticised a lot for a lot of speculation, and he seems to be very confident about some things which most other people just don't have the same confidence in. So Chris is right, he does do a lot of kind of a priori theology, saying, so for example, he makes one kind of a priori argument for the Trinity from theism, and he says that if theism is true, then the Trinity is very probably, or like quite probably true, just in nature of what it means to say that God exists. And so, yeah, he has been criticized a lot on that. I'm not convinced his arguments are particularly unreasonable. So, for example, in this book on the resurrection, he says that the probability of theism given natural theology is 0.5. So he only assumes, for example, that natural theology makes it kind of uncertain whether God exists or not. He doesn't kind of
It's a fairly modest claim in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously people would still disagree with it. So Chris, being an atheist, I assume, would disagree that it's even as high as 0.5.
Of course.
Yeah. but certainly I think you can at least, I think his some of his probabilities, at least there, are defensible, even if he is a bit too confident about certain things.
Mm.
I should add one of the other really important factors in coming to this prior probability that Swinburne talks about is what reasons God would have for becoming incarnate and resurrecting Jesus. So you'll often hear him talk about resurrection, whether in these discussions you'll hear people debating whether there's a religious context for the miracle. And actually it turns out a religious context makes a huge difference to the probability of a miracle occurring.
Mm.
So if, for example, God has really good reasons for becoming incarnate and for raising Jesus from the dead, then the resurrection becomes a lot more probable.
Right. It's all about context in the end. Chris, just be interested in your responses to some of the things Callum's been talking about in terms of Swinburne's approach to this.
Yeah, so I want to return to the point I made earlier about Mormonism. Callum is correct that there's actually a fairly good evidence that, you know, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, was just a fraud. And that's something we can say because we know vastly more about the life of Joseph Smith than we do about the life of Jesus. We have much better sources for the life of Joseph Smith than we do for Jesus, so we're in a pretty good position to figure out what happened with the founding of Mormonism in a way that we're not with Christianity. But even if we didn't have that evidence, I strongly suspect that even though Callum believes in God, I strongly suspect that even though he believes in God, and even if he didn't have his American friends, you know, telling him that Mormonism is deceitful and so on, I suspect he would be, you know, skeptical of claims like, you know, for example, the Mormon Church has a statement that was signed by three early Mormons, none of whom were Joseph Smith, a statement signed by three witnesses saying that an angel came down from heaven to validate the Book of Mormon. And I suspect, maybe I'm wrong to suspect this, but I suspect that Callum would be, you know, kind of skeptical of that, even without direct evidence that Joseph Smith was dishonest. Am I correct to suspect that, Callum?
I think you'd probably be correct, yeah.
So, in the context of the sort of arguments that Swinburne makes, what basis would you have for being skeptical? Because, you know, the providing of a new revelation, or a previously, you know, lost revelation of God, seems like, you know, if you think religious context is the key factor, you know, why wouldn't providing this important piece of revelation be enough religious context to make it plausible that, you know, this miracle would happen?
Again, as I've already mentioned, I don't know too much about Mormonism, so I won't be able to comment a huge amount. I've mentioned kind of the three main factors in assessing the probability of kind of a religion being correct. So one is kind of the probability of God, which probably supports Mormonism just as well as Christianity. The other is the evidence kind of concerning the miracle in question. In that case, I'm just not aware of the miracles in Mormon theology or of the evidence for them, but from what I've heard, it doesn't seem particularly compelling, whereas the naturalistic explanations of the resurrection do seem to me very
I mean, what you're saying is that when it comes to claims about Mormon miracles, there's a greater probability of a naturalistic explanation that fits with the data than with the case of the resurrection, where a naturalistic explanation just doesn't fit, as far as you can see, with the data.
Yeah.
So the fact that we have evidence now, apologies to Mormon listeners who are not here to defend against their prophet, but that there are records at the time that Joseph Smith was a fraudster and a liar and so on, and was prone to making things up and exaggeration, is all kind of evidence around those claims that he made that Mormonism, that these events were not true. Whereas for you, Callum, presumably it's rather the opposite with the Christian claims, which is that there were very good reasons for people not to be talking about a resurrection and so on, but they still did in that context. And so if you were asked to give a reason for one and not the other, that would be kind of where you're coming from, presumably.
So that would be part of it, and the other part of it would be kind of the particular religious context. So I've said religious context of a miracle and miracle claims are important, but obviously it's not necessarily helpful just to have some kind of religious context. It has to be the right kind of one. So, for example, I can see very good reasons why God would want to vindicate Jesus' teaching by resurrecting him, because I think Jesus taught a lot of very good things. I thought he was, obviously as a Christian, I think he was very sincere and a very good person. And I can think of a lot of reasons why God would choose Jesus to be a prophet and to become incarnate in him. Whereas I don't see comparably good reasons to think that God would want to vindicate Mormon teaching. Obviously, a lot of that is because I don't know much about Mormonism, but there's still the asymmetry there. I still just don't see the reasons why God would want to vindicate.
I mean, Chris, from this perspective, I mean, you don't share, obviously, Callum's belief in God. Now, does this make a significant difference, obviously, to how you then assign these prior probabilities and so on to the resurrection, which essentially make a naturalistic explanation, however unlikely, more likely than the idea that Jesus rose from the dead?
Yes and no. In theory, it seems like, whether or not God exists should have a big impact on, what you think of the prior probability of miracles, though... honestly, I think even if I, accepted the arguments of natural theology, I think the deists, the, people who believe in God based on natural theology but, don't think he reveals himself through miracles, I think the deists would have a pretty good case. If there's one, takeaway message that I hope people listening to this remember, it's that when you are evaluating these kind of arguments for, like, Jesus's resurrection, get in the habit of asking yourself what you would make of similar arguments made in favor of another religion like Mormonism or Islam or so on. Because Callum admitted that he doesn't know much about Mormon teachings, but, for Mormons who've been raised with Mormon teachings and who think they're a good thing, they, probably makes perfect sense to them that, God would want to vindicate Mormonism. And imagine, hearing them making that argument, you probably wouldn't be very convinced. The other thing to, make clear here in terms of the evidence, which is the other point Callum mentioned, as I said, the evidence for the resurrection is essentially what we have in the Bible. And traditionally, the Christian church claimed that the four Gospels, the four main accounts of Jesus' life in the Bible, were, either written by apostles or companions of apostles. So these are, first or at least secondhand testimony. But that's something that's been called into question by more recent biblical scholarship. And, if you take the more, I don't know if you want to call it liberal or mainstream view of biblical scholarship, I think you've got the case that the Mormons have better evidence because, they've got these signed statements by three early Mormons. There's another statement they got signed by eight early Mormons. And, within the Bible, what can really claim to be definitely an eyewitness statement? Well, the epistles of Paul, not all of the epistles of Paul are accepted as authentic, but some are, and Paul did claim to have, had a vision of Jesus. And everything else is on kind of shaky ground. So, in terms of the evidence, I think the Mormons almost have a better case, at least in terms of just looking at the positive evidence. Now, there's a lot of negative evidence against Mormonism, though I have to wonder if we knew more about Christianity, what if we had good documentation for the origins of Christianity, what embarrassing facts would surface?
Well, that's speculation, I suppose, but any response on that sort of general point?
I think it obviously depends a lot on the nature of the evidence you have. And I think I just disagree. I mean, I'd agree that there's some negative evidence against Mormonism, and there are kind of some negative epistemic features of Mormonism compared to Christianity. For example, in Mormonism, you do have the alternative explanation that Joseph Smith was a fraud, whereas in Christianity, that explanation is really, the explanation that Jesus was a fraud seems to me a lot more improbable.
How do you tell? I don't have any idea how we would know if Jesus was sincere. I mean, if I had to guess, I'd guess sure he was sincere, but how would you know?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is obviously he was crucified and prepared to do that. And not only was he crucified kind of along with his claims, but he didn't really have any material gain before that either. And it was, it seems to me, pretty inconceivable that he would have foreseen any material gain in the future either. So there's the sincerity of Jesus, and then there's also the sincerity of the disciples. It seems to me that the evidence regarding persecution of Christians in the first century is very strong evidence, and that most of the disciples, or all of the disciples, had pretty much nothing to gain by going to their death. So, I mean, the sincerity of those seems to me on quite good grounds. I mean, there are various sources.
Okay, I have to stop you there, because the evidence for, you know, the accounts of the disciples' martyrdoms are pretty much in every case on, you know, even shakier grounds than the accounts of Jesus's life. There's a book, a good book that just recently came out about this, by a Notre Dame scholar. I believe her name was Candida Moss. The book was called The Myth of Persecution. And, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, Christians shouldn't assume that what they learned about the apostles in Sunday school is of a historical truth. I'm sorry, but...
Well, I mean, that's kind of a separate area that we... I mean, I'd love to get her on, actually, and do a discussion on that, because I think it's a fascinating one to open up. I mean, coming... We're nearly out of time in this second section, and then we'll have to wrap things up, folks. So one question that kind of is at the forefront for me as well on this point is for you, Chris... If miracles are just by definition for you as an atheist unlikely, then kind of does that essentially rule out the resurrection as a starting point anyway? Well, however good the evidence was that Jesus had resurrected, the fact you don't believe in God means, well, then that just isn't a valid explanation.
I wouldn't say that no evidence could possibly, you know, be good evidence for a resurrection, but, you know, certainly... you know, with the only evidence we have being the Bible, you know, that comes nowhere close to the amount of evidence we would need. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. I'm gonna take a break now, and we'll go to a slightly early break, and so that we can leave a little more time in the next section for starting to wrap things up. You're listening to a discussion between Callum Miller, a young Christian apologist, who blogs at dovetheology.com, if you want to follow his blog there, and is one of the founders of Apologetics UK. He's in conversation today on Unbelievable with Chris Halquist, who's a young atheist blogger, trenchant critic of apologetics, blogs at the Uncredible Hulk on Patheos. So you can go and check that out as well. Discussing today the probability of the resurrection of Christ. And I've got a few more questions I want to throw in as we come to the next section of the program. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. We'll be back in a moment's time. Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's Saturday afternoon, time of the week when we get Christians and non-Christians together here on the debate show that aims to get you thinking. And you may be listening via the internet, via the podcast, premier.org.uk/unbelievable is where you can find all the links to that if you are not a podcast listener but would like to download past shows. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback in a short moment's time to previous shows. Just a quick mention, though, of what's coming up next week if you come back at the same time or via podcast. Another American voice joins us, Greg Kuchel. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Kuchel, I think, it might be the correct pronunciation. But he's well known out in the States in terms of apologetics. He runs a regular radio show called Stand to Reason. It's a ministry as well. And he'll be joining me. He's been spending some time in the UK just recently. And we'll be taking a few different skeptics' questions on the Bible, on the existence of God and so on. So I'm looking forward to having him on. Lots of people have asked for him to be a contributor on the show, and he's going to be here in studio with me next week. So come back for that. Greg Kuchel from Stand to Reason will be joining me. Right now, it's back into the final part of our discussion on the probability of the resurrection of Christ.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And joining me on today's show have been Callum Miller, a young Christian apologist and Oxford Medical graduate who's developed a great passion for apologetics. You can follow him at dovetheology.com, where he blogs. He's also part of the Apologetics UK group, where you can find them on Facebook and that sort of thing if you're interested in discussing these issues. Chris Halquist is a young atheist blogger, trenchant critic of apologetics, especially people like William Lane Craig, and he blogs on those sorts of issues at The Uncredible Hulk on Patheos, which you can find at patheos.com/blogs/Hulk, as in H-A-L-L-Q. Gentlemen, we've had a really interesting discussion that's kind of taken us in different directions so far. One thing that occurs to me when all of this talk of probabilities and so on is going on, Callum, is that a couple of weeks ago we had that discussion on this show between a presuppositionalist, Scott Oliphant, who takes the view that actually any talk of probabilities of the resurrection is an apologetic dead end. In fact, he said that very specifically on the show. He feels that, well, if you're a Christian, you believe that the resurrection happened. There's no point in arguing about probabilities of these things happening. He takes a very different approach to the issue of evidence and so on. What's your general response to that? Because it just seems like we should talk about that in the context of him saying that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, just as a first general point, whether or not Christians should be certain about the resurrection, most, I would say, aren't. So even if kind of Christians have an obligation to be certain about the resurrection, it's just a fact that many aren't. And so it still makes sense, I think, to talk about degrees of confidence in it. But I also think Christians have an obligation to be rational and to genuinely kind of seek the truth in a rational way and go about their belief making processes in a rational way. And it just seems to me that to be certain of something which isn't kind of a really obvious necessary truth just doesn't seem to me to be kind of rationally warranted. And so I mean, personally, I don't see anywhere in the... So that's kind of from first principles. I think we should generally go where the evidence takes us and go where probability takes us and not be certain about things unless they're kind of obvious necessary truths. In addition to those first principles, I just simply don't see anything in Christian theology or in the Bible saying you should be certain about this. Nowhere in the Bible does it say kind of you should be absolutely certain about all your beliefs. You're not allowed to have any kind of uncertainty or doubt or anything like that. So, I mean, I just don't see any argument, I think, for it at all.
Okay. I mean, let's talk about this issue that we've been talking about whether when, you know, the prior probability of whether a miracle happened is greatly influenced, as we've talked about, by whether God exists. Now, you believe in God. Chris doesn't believe in God. And that's going to make a big difference. I mean, just this last week, about a week ago, I posted an email I'd received on my Facebook page from someone who gave a story of having been witness to, in fact, would have been responsible for in terms of praying for someone in Peru and witnessing, they said, an eyeball growing back in a socket and saying, well, if you want evidence for the regeneration of a limb through prayer, evidence of a miracle, here you go. So I posted that up on my Facebook page and asked, you know, what are people's responses? And lots of atheists came on saying, what a ridiculous load of rubbish. This is not proof, evidence. One email from some random person does not equate to evidence. And I was absolutely happy to say, yes, I don't believe that a miracle happened just on the basis of one email. But I was kind of interested to say for myself as a Christian, I don't rule it out either. Now, this person could be lying, could be mistaken, could be deluded, whatever. But on an atheist view, that has to be one of those, has to be the explanation. Whereas as a Christian, I can still hold open the possibility that a miracle has occurred, though I'd need, obviously, to investigate and get a lot more evidence before I was prepared to sort of move from agnosticism to, maybe something did happen. Now, is this kind of a tangible example of what we're talking about here when it comes to miracle claims? Chris, will you always say a miracle has to have a naturalistic explanation, i.e. the person was lying, mistaken, deluded, or whatever? Is that always just a fact of the fact that you are an atheist, that therefore any miracle claim is by definition impossible?
You know, it's not really an issue of by definition, it's an issue of, you know, extrapolating from our experience of the world. The point I should have made probably before the break, you know, when I compare Mormonism and Christianity and, you know, see, you know, all the embarrassing things we know about the founding of Mormonism and wonder about the origins of Christianity, if only we knew more, it's really not just speculation, because, you know, there are many cases like that, case after case after case, where we know quite a bit about, you know, the source of an alleged miracle claim, and it looks like we've got pretty good indicators that the claim isn't true, you know, for whatever reason. Sometimes people are lying, sometimes people are mistaken, you know. So when you take all those cases together, it, I think, provides us a pretty good basis for inferring that the cases we don't know as much about are also not genuine miracles. It's not a matter of just defining something as impossible. It's a matter of, you know, applying what we know about the world to figure out what's really going on.
Okay. So if you like, being skeptical about what you do know about leads you to being skeptical about the cases that you're not so sure about, but on the basis of what you've already seen, you'd apply the same kind of level of skepticism. Is that a valid sort of way of approaching the miracle question for you, Callum?
I think so. I mean, it depends, obviously, how, whether you believe in the resurrection and whether you think there's good evidence for that. Certainly, I think if you don't already believe in God, then I think you need quite, like, very strong evidence for a miracle to then be convinced of the miracle and of God's existence. I think it takes quite strong evidence to be able to do that.
I mean, sometimes people do present the resurrection, arguments for the resurrection, as evidence for God.
Yeah.
Now, is that the wrong way to go about things? Because really, for the resurrection to be probable, you have to have a prior belief in God.
It's not actually kind of wrong in that sense. So obviously, if you can give a high prior probability to God's existence anyway, that will help your case. But you definitely don't have to already have a high probability of theism before arguing for the resurrection. So you can actually prove with probability theory that even if the existence of God has a very, very, very low probability to begin with, you can still end up reasonably being a theist on the basis of the resurrection, as long as the evidence of the resurrection is strong enough. So I don't think it's a mistake to argue for the resurrection directly without arguing for God beforehand.
Mm, okay. Chris, we're running out of time. So a phrase that's often bandied about, and I'd be interested in your response to this, is extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And is this one of those areas where the resurrection just doesn't have enough extraordinary evidence for what is actually an extraordinary claim?
Absolutely.
I've done your job for you there, haven't I, Chris?
Yeah.
I mean, so for you, whatever, A, you're saying you just don't believe these probability values that have been assigned by Swinburne and co are justified, and that we don't have enough evidence for what is a, you know, we wouldn't accept this kind of thing in other cases without a lot better evidence than we have for this one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Okay, so we've got your point of view there. So what do you make then, Callum, of this point for extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? Because I know that some people, William Lane Craig, for instance, I've heard him in debate say that's just not, that doesn't follow in this case, that you have to have extraordinary evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ to be the best explanation of the facts surrounding it.
Obviously, it depends a lot on what the claim really precisely means. So it's often left quite vague and it's unclear what it means. And if it's that unclear, you might as well just come up with something equally apparently obvious, like funny claims require funny evidence, or like implausible claims require implausible evidence. So you really need to I think it needs to be characterized better to be able to appraise it. But in the sense of if something is really improbable to begin with, then you need better evidence to then accept it. I think it's true. But I think that changes it slightly, because it's not clear that extraordinary just means improbable. So while I think, for example, that the resurrection is extraordinary in some sense, I don't think it's that improbable to begin with. But then I also think that the evidence really is very good for the resurrection, so that even if it was very improbable, I think it would still be reasonable to believe in it.
Well, it's been fascinating to go around this for a little while this afternoon. Thank you both for being on with me to talk about this. If people wanted to find out a bit more about this, is there a book that they could read, Callum, something that Richard Swinburne has written along these lines?
So Richard Swinburne's own book mainly on this is called The Resurrection of God Incarnate. And then his book on the existence of God and the natural theological arguments is called The Existence of God. So those are the two key ones for his work, I think.
Okay. Any way you would point people towards looking for the atheist perspective on this, Chris?
Yeah, well, I've got a book I wrote available for download for free on my website, on my blog. There's a tab at the top that says free ebooks. And if they want, you know, a perspective of, you know, someone who's not just a blogger and who's a actual scholar, not specifically about the resurrection, but Bart Ehrman's book, Jesus Interrupted, is a very good introduction to New Testament scholarship in general. And if, you know, you want to know what, someone who, you know, studied at, you know, Princeton Theological Seminary rather than just what evangelical scholars say, if you want to know what more mainstream scholarship says about, you know, the New Testament, that is the number one book I would recommend.
Great. Well, I'll certainly link as well to programs, for instance, that Bart Ehrman have contributed to on this show with the podcast of today's show to give further resources as well on this. Fascinating stuff. Thank you both for being with me. And as Chris mentioned, you can find his blog and the downloads that you mentioned there at patheos.com/blogs/halq. Which is kind of a mouthful, but H-A-L-L-Q is what you're looking for, or just type in The Uncredible Halq onto Google. Similarly, Callum Miller you can find at dovetheology.com and at the UK Apologetics website and Facebook group as well. So thanks, gentlemen, again for being with me. It's been really interesting to have this discussion. And if you want any more resources, you want to pick up the podcast that I've mentioned that Bart Ehrman and others have contributed to in the past, then of course you can go to the Unbelievable website and follow the links there. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. In the meantime, thanks very much for joining me, gentlemen, and perhaps we'll have you back again for another discussion at some point in the future.
Okay, yeah, thanks for having us on, and maybe we'll talk again.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks again to my guests today. And if you want to get in touch, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be lovely to hear from you. And I do try to get back to as many first-time emailers as possible. Now, as I mentioned, we did have some problems with our email system in the last week or so, moving over to some new servers and technical things. And what it meant was that the unbelievable@premier.org.uk email address was bouncing back, I think. We hope that's been fixed. If you are still getting a bounce back, if you do send me something, apologies, and it might be a bit of a work in progress. But a few emails did manage to get through in the last week at least. And so thanks to Gabriel and also Larry, who got in touch after last week's show. They were responding to the discussion between Holly Ordway, who was a convert from atheism to Christianity via literature and poetry. And she was in conversation with Laura Miller, a sort of agnostic/atheist book critic, and who'd written a book on her experience of finding out that the C.S. Lewis Narnia stories were actually sort of Christian allegories and being very disappointed at that. Well, they had a fascinating conversation on the rights and wrongs of using literature as a form of evangelism. Whether there's a sort of transcendence in literature and so on. It was great to have both of them join me last week. Gabriel wants to chime in on Narnia and literature, says, I appreciated this topic, and until now I'd not heard anyone discuss this experience. There's something about literature and taking it on its own terms that all people, especially adults, should be guarded just as we should practice taking people on their own terms as primary sources of their experience. I wanted to say I think there's something telling about how we are maturing with regards to missing what is present or suggested by others, whether by their fiction or non-fiction stories. It seems to be a fact that we often miss what is present in the world around us and in others' experiences.
But we do well to grow and mature, forming habits of attending what is present in our world and in people. Larry in Portland, Oregon says, just a note to say I thoroughly enjoyed the interview and discussion with Laura Miller and Holly Ordway today, so much so that I went and listened to the 2009 interview with Laura Miller on your podcast feed immediately afterwards. I found that show very interesting as well, but disagreed strongly, among other things, with Laura Miller's claim that C.S. Lewis was racist in his portrayal of the Calormenes. While Michael Ward, who was the Christian guest on that show from 2009, while Michael Ward aptly pointed out Lewis's portrayal of certain Calormenes as highly virtuous, I thought he was also wrong in adding that Lewis was indeed still somewhat racist due to his knowledge of foreigners having come primarily from history books. One advantage this may have had is of giving Lewis a broader cultural perspective than our modern Western pluralistic worldview, in which every group brings just as much good to the mix as the next. The fact is that cultures of all skin tones have existed throughout time and do still exist, which are indeed deeply cruel, sensual and harsh. Surely Lewis was well aware that this was not an issue of skin tone. The light-skinned false Narnians of presumably European descent who enslave old Narnia in Prince Caspian are certainly as cruel and terrible as the Calormenes. Then, too, there are the Narnian slave traders in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. You have me thinking quite a lot, as I'm still listening to your podcast at every opportunity, trying to get caught up. Knowing that I can listen to Unbelievable at my job helps me face sometimes long days of manual labour, as I want to put myself through university. Larry, thanks for getting in touch, and all the best as you study to, as you work to try and get yourself through university. Appreciate you getting in touch. Again, if you want to email, and hopefully it's up and working by the time you respond to today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, interact via the Facebook page, which continues to grow in popularity. In fact, a lot of a rather long discussion in the last week or two on the issue of miracles, very pertinent to today's topic, obviously. And I read earlier on in the show, or I brought into the conversation between Callum and Chris, this email that I'd received, and I read out the week before last, which was all about Alex telling us that perhaps he has an example of a missing organ, limb, whatever, growing back, being replaced. He talked about the fact that while he was in Peru on a mission trip, he prayed for someone and he saw in front of him their eye grow back into a socket. And he threw that in the pot as a possible rejoinder to the claim that you never hear any story of an amputee, whatever, being healed. So I put that up on the Facebook and lots of response from a number of atheists and Christians, and particularly Ralph Jones, one of a former guest on this program. I'm sure we'll probably have him on again at some point. Very skeptical of such claims, talking about the fact that coming down to the fact that even if he saw something like that happen in front of him, he wouldn't expect others to believe it on his testimony, because it's the nature of miracles that we should rightly be skeptical of them per se. There was a lot of discussion along those lines. What are the evidence for a miracle? What would you need to believe in one, and that kind of thing. And I was pleased to see Alex as well, after I pointed him in the direction of this this conversation going on the Facebook page of the of Unbelievable, weighing in himself with a little bit more detail on the circumstances of this miracle as he sees it. If you want to check out the full discussion that's been going on there, you'll have to go to the Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/unbelievablejb, and just scroll down a few entries to the discussion I started a week last Friday, and you'll see some of the fullness of the discussion that's been going on. But here's Alex, just to give some more perspective on this. And so he says, Justin pointed me to this, so I thought I'd throw in a few points based off what's been discussed so far. Firstly, I'm part of the Reformed section of Christianity, not prone to believe in or expect miracles. To be completely honest, if someone were to tell me they'd witnessed an eye regrow into someone's head, I wouldn't believe them either. Secondly, my background's in business management, and I held a few jobs in that field before finally landing in IT, where I'm currently working and studying. Thirdly, beyond school studies, I've spent quite a bit of time studying theology, astronomy, the sciences in general, debate, and recently I've been looking into history. I'm a fairly intelligent person who likes to discuss things and prove things. I don't like taking it by faith, and I find the idea shallow for both Christianity and thinkers in general. Number four, I've never used this event in an attempt to convert someone. For the most part, I don't mention this event to people unless it comes up in conversation or is specifically about have you ever witnessed a miracle sort of discussion. I prefer to use the gospel and the gospel alone as proof of salvation. Either Jesus is who he says he is or he isn't. Either he did the things he says he did or he didn't. And number five, I've never had any mental issue or been accused of having them. In addition, I'm not prone to exaggeration or lying. I like to take things at face value as much as I can. Even in interactions with people who disagree with me, I attempt to honestly and accurately understand and properly express their point of view while still disagreeing with it. And this is just in sort of answering some of the questions and concerns that have come up earlier on in the debate thread, as people have questioned, you know, well, we don't know anything about this Alex character. He could be just completely making it up. He could be out of his head, whatever. So anyway, so that's Alex's sort of rejoinder on that. Bit more information on the story then, he says. It was 11, almost 12 years ago in Peru. I was 15 at the time and was there as part of a missions trip with my church. I don't know the name of the town or the organization my church partnered with. I have since moved and no longer attend it, though I am in communication with some who were present. The night before the event, we were praying for things we wished to see on the trip, and a girl asked to see God grow an eyeball into someone's head. The next morning, we went to a local church to preach the gospel and pray for the congregants. There were about a dozen of us, and the rest of the approximate 100 individuals were local Peruvians. While we were waiting for the service to start, a man walked in with his eye missing. It was completely sunken in and scarred shut. The girl who'd prayed for the healing looked at me and said, "We have to pray for him." She wanted me to be there because our rule was that a girl couldn't pray for a man alone and vice versa. At the time, we were sent out to pray for individuals in the congregation. The two of us walked over to the man and asked him what he'd like us to pray for. A translator confirmed he wanted us to pray that God would heal his missing eye. We agreed, placed our hands on top of his missing eye, and prayed for him. At the end of our prayer, I felt something move underneath my hand, and I pulled it back to look at what was happening. His previously scarred shut eye was open, and underneath I could see the white of an eyeball. The man reached up and touched his eye and said something I didn't understand because the translator had moved on. Another person took our attention away and asked us to pray for them, so we did. After the prayer time was complete, the pastor of the congregation gave a message, and during the message, the man we'd prayed for came onto the stage and gave a testimony about his eye, which was translated for me. It was at that time I was told that he lost his eyeball as a child in some sort of accident. As he spoke, his eye opened more and more, and by the time we left church that day, he had two functioning eyeballs where once there was only one. That is the event in its entirety. In 2001, our group had no smartphones and the cameras on our lame phones were poor at best, and we didn't have phones with us anyway as we weren't supposed to bring them, and as far as I know, no pictures were taken by our group of the man before or after his eye was healed, though I could be mistaken. After being a party to this event, there are two ways I can go with it. Firstly, I could say that someone in our group or the missions organisation we partnered with heard the girl's prayer, set up an elaborate trick using some sort of makeup or special effects to evaporate or come apart while our warm hands were over it. In that scenario, the man is likely an actor, and the pastor, and maybe even the whole congregation at the church we went to, is likely to be all in on it. All of this to convince about a dozen children that God does miraculous things. Or secondly, the other scenario is that God heard the prayer of a teenage girl and gifted her with a direct answer to it. So you have options of your own. Firstly, you can believe I'm telling the truth and either I was tricked or it really happened. But whatever the case, I witnessed something. Or second, I'm a liar out to stick it to those atheists with all my anecdotal evidence. Like I said, I'd be pretty skeptical about a story of healing as well. But I was there when it happened, and regardless of what you think of me or this event, it doesn't change what I saw and experienced, says Alex. Thank you, Alex. Well, that in itself generated another heap of responses as well to Alex sort of giving a bit more detail on that story. It is the case, though, that very often miracle claims, there isn't what most atheists would want in terms of some kind of documentary record, video, medical records maybe before and after. Now, I know that there are those out there. There are people who could bring along a medical record of this was my medical state before and after I got healed or whatever. And very often, though, obviously, a naturalistic explanation is still the preferred option, that strange things happen, as it were. And that's why so often I think this challenge is put forward, isn't it, about we need to see something literally growing again in front of us, a limb being replaced or whatever. Now, the question is, I suppose, are you willing to accept Alex's testimony? Or if you're an atheist and it's just is far-fetched by definition on your worldview, must he by definition be deluded, lying, mistaken, or something else? That's the way that Ralph and others on the group still have to see it, as far as they're concerned. But personally, now that I've had a bit more input from Alex, you know, I think the evidence has shifted a little bit more in favour for me of believing that he did experience this. You know, I would have to have some obvious, pretty strong evidence against it at this point to say that he didn't experience something that looked a lot like a miracle. So I've moved from agnosticism to cautious interest in this possibly being true. And I think this is all getting us towards maybe we need to do a show on miracles. We've done it before in a few different ways, but yeah, I think we'll do another show on miracles at some point. So look out for that at some point down the line. Thank you. Anyway, it's been really interesting having that interaction. Of course, Twitter is also a place where you can get in touch with the show. That's at UnbelievableJB if you want to get in touch that way. Thanks also to lots of other people who have emailed in the past. Really interested to hear what your show suggestions are and things like that. Rob Colvin wants to get Justin Barrett on some of his more controversial claims, including that atheism might be in some sense learned. You think it could be an extremely engaging thing? Justin Barrett is a sort of works in the area of psychology and mind, I think, and that whole issue of whether belief in God is sort of innate at birth and whether it has to be sort of educated out of us or something, unlearned, if you don't believe in God. Lots of others here. Try and squeeze a few more in next time. But for the moment, thank you very much for being with me today on the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Do get in touch with the show. Always interested to hear what you think about each episode. So do come again at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
Someone I've wanted to have on for years on this show, joining me right here in the studio, Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason. He's been doing his own apologetics and radio show podcast for a long time. We're going to be hearing from him about that journey as he takes questions from some skeptical listeners to Unbelievable. They put some of their tough questions to Greg about the Bible, the existence of God, and whether God communicates well enough, I think, is one of the topics next week. So come back for that. Look forward to having you with me, same time, same place, here on Unbelievable. Until then, have a great week.